people everywhere are winning big, playing the Monopoly game at McDonald's. Barbara Gray won a Sea-Doo jet boat. Mary Wallingsford won a $2,000 Citibank shopping spree. Kyle McKinnon won a Sega Saturn with a Daytona USA game. Jerry Colombo won a Dodge Viper. And there are two $1 million prizes left. With millions of prizes left, you could be next. So take a break and get a break at McDonald's.
Have you had your break today?
I mean, how crazy bullshit is that?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 288 for the week of February 3rd, 2020. I am hamburger-based local governance official David T. Cole, and I'm here with McNugget Sarah D. Bunting.
Dip me.
Hot apple pie Tara Ariano.
I'm baked.
And McDLT Eve Beatty.
Don't worry about the gigantic box required to keep my hot side hot and cool side cool. The earth can take it.
Welcome back to another episode of Extra Hot Great. It's a murder of work, spouses. We are so glad to welcome back to the show our good friend and my co-editor at the Best Evidence True Crime Newsletter, Eve Beatty. Hello, Eve.
Eve.
Hello.
Yay!
That was so smoothly integrated. Now I'm all thrown off. We had to have Eve on to talk about our main topic this week, which is true crime of a sort. We'll get into it. We are speaking about McMillions, the six-part documentary series from HBO, and, as I am apparently obliged to point out, executive producer Mark Wahlberg. This chronicles, quote, the stranger-than-fiction true story of how $24 million was stolen from the McDonald's Monopoly game of the 1990s, the mystery mastermind behind the scam, and the intrepid FBI agents on his trail, end quote. McMillions premiered Monday on HBO. I have some thoughts, but Eve, I would love to start with you. Have you enjoyed what you've seen, and will this series be taking its place among the great scamumentary properties like The Dropout, The Imposter, or Dirty John?
Oh, yeah. Well, I watched all three. I think we have to see how it plays out. But if nothing else, and this is something that, you know, we talked about on Best Evidence, this is a series that's sort of based on a Daily Beast report from 2018 by a guy named Jeff Mache. And when this long form piece sort of went up for quote unquote auction, not only did HBO nab it for the documentary, but Ben Affleck nabbed it to direct and possibly cast himself in it. Sort of the latest word is that Matt Damon will be playing somebody. God, I hope Doug. and so, if nothing else, this is something that people are going to continue to talk about, you know, as, you know, whatever Ben Affleck is basically doing, like Argo 2 with this. So I think that this isn't one of those, you know, sort of true crime things where we all talk about it for 2 weeks and it goes away. It's going to come up again when this movie sort of rolls out. But yeah, I was exceptionally engaged in it. And I think part of it is that it does just seem so ridiculous that they got away with it for so long, and that then the feds collected evidence the way they did. It just seems so impossible that you kind of have to see the real people to even believe that it happened.
Yeah, and even then, it's pretty difficult to believe that it happened. And every time I felt like the first episode I thought was fantastic, and the next two I thought were a little more stately in pace. But like every time you think like, well, why are we sort of disappearing down this rabbit hole of like this side story? Then you wind up in this other amazing tale of, for example, the strip club.
Called, oh my God.
That was like basically converted into a church with like chicken wings and pasties and Bibles. I mean, spoiler.
We should try to focus just on the only one that will have aired that our listeners will have been able to see at this point, and try to avoid the twists that could come ahead, because I haven't read that Daily Beast story because I don't want to know. And when they got to the end of that first episode, and it was like that big reveal about Uncle Jerry, I was like, oh shit, because I hadn't heard anything about this case.
No, neither had I.
I agree that the pace was like a little bit uneven, but I was really engaged by it. And for sure, Doug, as Eve mentioned, is is definitely a character. The fact that he has the idea of interviewing these past winners after he gets that someone at some point has gotten a tip that there's fraud in this game. And he wants to look into it primarily because he's bored. On the one hand, Doug, please get your ADHD treated. But on the other, like, good instincts, because there's definitely something here. And I know from the Best Evidence newsletter, which you mentioned earlier, that Eve, you read Margaret Lyon's review in the New York Times, where she criticized this for being insufficiently cinematic, which she said it would have made a better podcast than a TV miniseries, but you don't agree. So speak on that.
See, I think it's hugely cinematic because, you know, like I said, I feel like it's, you know, Argo too. I can see why Ben Affleck was interested in it. And I think that, you know, if this ends up with a dramatic adaptation that is done well, it's going to be one of those things, another one of those things like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where, you know, because it's going to be like up its ass about filmmaking and TV and all that, and have all of that dumb inside baseball stuff in it.
Right.
So, I mean, it's cinematic in that it is about, I mean, not cinema, it's about, you know, filming things, though. It's about all of that stuff. You know, like, that's something that, without giving too much away, you know, people keep talking about how these feds are operating this sort of, you know, documentary thing that is a fake documentary to track down all these winners. And it's like, I was a boom guy and I didn't know how to operate a boom. I was this guy and I didn't know how to do that. And, you know, of course, these people don't know. I wouldn't know if I were being filmed, like, who was operating stuff, right? But, you know, you just see all of the... you know, Soderbergh could do this just as well, right? You see all the opportunities to make this a hilarious inside baseball sort of thing. And it's like, does it get any more cinematic than that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I when we got to the end of that first episode, I said to Dave that I was getting big The Informant vibes off it, which, of course, is a Steven Soderbergh movie.
Totally.
Dave, were you bothered by the Errol Morrissey reenactments that they sort of inserted to flesh it out?
I feel like they could have done a better job with them. They were sort of washed out, and they're hesitating to show faces because they're obviously not the same people.
Right.
But I feel like it kind of hurt the visuals. In a perfect world, that whole thing would be played by their analog in McDonald's land. So there would be, you know, Big Mac officer, Mary McCheese, Grimace is Jerry Colombo, you know, like everybody would have an equal. And you have to remember, McDonald's land goes back a long time, and there's been a lot of characters that have been dropped from the line. I don't even think they have McDonald's land anymore, but there used to be quite the cast. Mm-hmm. I think today they still have Early Bird, maybe. Grimace and Hamburglar and Ronald, I think might be it.
Yeah.
But they had like the Fry Guys and the Pirate. There's pirate character. There's a whole bunch, right?
Yep.
In a perfect world, that's what the reenactments are. Yeah. So the visuals that they actually presented were whatever. They're just kind of bland, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like for how crazy and weird the story was, the visuals kind of brought the energy down. But speaking about the production stuff, have we just all accepted that the documentarians are never going to be mic'd while interviews, and every time they have to ask a question...
has to be talking like this. So what do you think about that thing over here?
Like, why can't they mic themselves? They know they're going to be asking questions. And yeah, sure, 98% of the questions are not in the finished product, but there's usually one or two where they can't figure out a way to edit around it. Sure would be nice to actually hear them talk clearly. Is it that we just have this collective blind spot when it comes to the doc community where they forget to do that all the time? Like me, and like where I left my wallet or something? Or... is it that is like an established trope, and to hear it clearly wouldn't be the shorthand that it is now?
Right.
I suspect, as a fellow podcast producer, that it's probably an issue of room tone and like feedback, that the sound person insists that there only be one mic for cleanness of track, but I don't know.
I also think it could just be sort of like a gritty authenticity. I'm doing air quotes here.
Yeah.
You know, gritty authenticity thing, right? Like, oh, you know, because I'm not making myself part of the story. So I didn't want to insert myself, but I had to in this moment. Yeah. That sounds like I'm being a dick, but you know.
Oh, before I go on, I just want to mention, Sarah, in your intro, I originally mistyped your intro to McNugents. So let's figure out what that would be sometime. Maybe in the comments. What are McNugents? And do you want to eat them?
Cap gun in every Happy Meal, I suspect.
But the story is great. We all know McDonald's Monopoly game. The quick of it, these people that figured out how to get their hands on the winning pieces, which were inserted into the assembly line by hand, obviously, but kind of at random, but they figured out a way to get their hands on them, and they start distributing them, they being the mob, start distributing them to their friends and family members. And it is such like an audacious, weird entry point into the world of organized crime. So much so that I feel like this movie that they're talking about, that Affleck won the rights to, and by the way, I don't think this documentary is based on Daily Beast. Like, it's not like a, like, I'm sure they use reporting from it. The way I read it is the movie is what was optioned from the Daily Beast.
Right. This, I thought I read in the Times that they did their own reporting, and then the Daily Beast came out while they were kind of whatever.
Just to clear the record.
I mean, whatever.
No, I appreciate the correction.
This needs to be a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah. Burn after reading.
Yeah. Because it is so ridiculous on the surface. And there's so many dumb characters in them. It's very Fargo-esque.
No, truly, you're right.
How many dumb people are in on the crime.
You don't want it to be played like totally straight, like The Town or something. Where it's like, you know, Jeremy Renner's like hardcore guy.
Or how about Werner Herzog?
Oh my God, yeah.
Werner Herzog. What does McMillions mean to ourselves? I would like to see the baby.
He wasn't Jack Reacher, guys. He was good.
When you stare into the abyss, the Hamburglar stares back.
I do question whether this needs to be 6 hours of documentary. I felt like even in the first three, that could have easily been two, but it is still an interesting story. Like, there's not so much filler that you can't
power through it.
Mm. I feel like they decided on some temple reveals and stretched out the content in between those milestones to the detriment of the product as a whole, but it does keep your attention.
It does. Mm. And while being cautious about saying too much about future episodes that, as I said, our listeners won't have seen yet, isn't the big shock for this story that marketing companies, like the one that run this contest, this company called Simon, aren't probably, maybe, don't sue us, possibly, allegedly, maybe running scams on these kind of contests all the time? And don't we maybe assume that they are?
Typically, like, for lotteries and games of chance and whatnot like this, you have to be audited and be able to present the audit.
That's right. They did say that.
So, and they go through the mechanics of that where
you're right.
They printed the regular property pieces and the instant things for small items like fries and shakes that went into the general pool. That was still secure.
Yeah.
But then like the actual big ticket item pieces, peel off pieces, were like in a secure enclave within this printing area.
Right.
And the result, like there was a nuclear submarine double key ignition system for it.
Yeah.
And everything. Yes. So I feel like they, as a company with a system, had a system.
Right.
It's just that with every system, whether it be electronic or in the real world, the weakest point is always social.
Absolutely.
Whether it's social engineering to get a password from AT&T customer service over the phone to do like phone hacks and stuff like that. Or it's this where you figure out who is the person that, you know, actually has physical access to it. And that's your vector into possibly getting a hold of these pieces.
Right.
That part of it is still kind of intriguing and
for
stuff.
Sure.
So I think the company had it in there.
I hope that there are future episodes where they sort of are like, this was a wake up call to everyone who does contests like this to like audit their own processes to figure out where they were vulnerable. All right, here's another conspiracy theory for you. I'm just going to throw this out there. As we all heard, this show was produced by Mark Wahlberg. As we also all know, Mark Wahlberg has his own burger company, Wahlburgers. Is this meant to drive us away from McDonald's and towards Wahlburgers? E. Fady.
Well, listen, I'm glad you brought this up, Tara, because the Wahlburgers thing, whatever. It's actually interesting. Tim, my husband and I just yesterday were talking about how we are glad that we haven't seen Mark Wahlberg for a while because that thing he did about his daily routine just put me off so much. Dave, I'll send you the link so you can put it in the show notes, but it was this thing about how he basically, all he does all day is eat his weird sort of engineered meatballs and pray, and it really grossed me out. But I will say this, the timing on this is interesting I'm not saying this in a QAnon kind of way, but the timing on this is interesting because McDonald's arguably has faced an enormous amount of sort of scandals in recent months, everything from sort of piled upon allegations of racial discrimination and harassment to issues involving franchising to this whole sort of, there was a franchisee uprising that made headlines in my industry, I'm a food writer, that made headlines recently because franchisees were angry that they didn't have their own sort of chicken sandwich with which to compete with Popeyes and everybody else. And so it's a tough time for McDonald's right now. Their CEO had to step down after allegations of sexual harassment. McDonald's is sort of at a turning point and looking sort of less friendly and adorable and like the sort of institutional fallback that it's been for, you know, all of our lives. So to have this sort of come in, it's not a killing blow, but it has the potential to be a mortal blow if it really shakes people's sort of faith in McDonald's. And I think that that is why it's interesting that in the first episode, it is so prominently presented about McDonald's sent their security people and they came in and all that. Like, McDonald's is sort of being presented as being clean and mm-hmm. as much a victim as anyone else. Right. And without giving anything away, McDonald's is presented very positively. We do see Ronald, the Ronald that, you know, all of us old people remember from commercials and stuff. And he's presented, I mean, I recognize that voice immediately. I was looking away very positively. There is something sort of pleasant about how they're presenting McDonald's that made me wonder if McDonald's wasn't thinking about, God, we've really been in this shit for a while now. We need to make sure, you know, if you're going to get our involvement at all or be allowed to use our name, that you make us look halfway decent. Anyway, that's not really conspiracy theory, but I'm curious about all of it, given the problems that McDonald's has been having lately.
Interesting.
There's always a little bit of give and take when you actually have people from that still work at the organization in your dock, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yep.
You know, corporate had to give the green light for those people at some point. So, you know,
yeah.
You always want to think a documentary has no hands on it, but you got to believe at some point there was limits drawn.
Access journalism, guys. It's real. Yeah.
Sarah, you are, of course, a vegetarian like Dave. Do you ever partake of a Filet-O-Fish? And will you stop after watching this documentary?
I do. And no, I won't. Also, they're the best fries in the business.
They really are. Dave disagrees, and he is wrong, in my opinion.
Oh, is Dave a steak fries guy? Have we talked about this?
I like skin-on sort of 2x4 style fries.
Gotcha.
Well, you know, yeah. I've been a vegetarian for a long time, too. I just want to point that out. And I recently stopped at McDonald's drive-thru for the first time in about a decade when I was on a road trip. I will send you guys a link to how my dog behaved as soon as I brought the fries into the car. There is something on those fries. I have never seen him act like this before. So I don't know what they're doing with the fries. Maybe that's the fodder for another documentary. But whatever it is, it causes madness, at least among dogs.
I don't know, McDonald's fries, either they're molten hot when you get them and they stay that way for a weirdly long time, or they're served cold. And it's just extruded potato paste, been through the ringer and it's got stuff in it. So I don't know, they just taste very bland to me. Mm. And also I need a fry with enough crispiness that it can withstand the soaking power of a good dose of malt vinegar. Because
true.
I can't eat fries without malt vinegar, as is the British Commonwealth tradition.
Indeed.
That was one of the big changes moving from Canada to US and not having a malt vinegar option or even just a vinegar option when you got fries somewhere, unless you happen to go to a British pub or an actual dedicated fish and chip store, which are few and far between.
Yeah.
End of rant.
So McMillions, definitely worth sticking through the 6 episodes, even though we've only seen a few. We all agree it's worth checking out.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It can seem over directed in spots. I do think documentarians, in addition to needing to mic themselves at Dave's request, should probably stop putting like vintage footage of stuff in a fake vintage TV frame.
Yeah.
To show to viewers that is right up there with the drone shot for shit that's tired. But yeah, I thought that it did an excellent job without shortcutting to an animation of like a corporate relationship tree of showing the relationships between and among everyone and how they sort of were
to good wife it.
I was just gonna say a good fight song.
Exactly. We were spared that. I think it's well done, and I'm in for the rest of it for sure.
Yep, same.
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed Stick Super Dry Antiperspirant.
McMillions.
I was doing that nonstop.
It's time for Around the Dial, talking about things we're watching on TV lately. First up, Tara.
I'm going to talk about the last 8 episodes of BoJack Horseman, and I'm going to try and be even more spoiler careful than usual because I watched them, but Dave has not watched them yet.
Go ahead.
Well, nevertheless, it's possible some of our listeners haven't gotten to them either. There's a lot of TV.
Is Horseman a name, or is he actually a horse?
Netflix did that thing where it's the last season and they split it in half. It's annoying when they do this. I wish they wouldn't, but that's a rant for another day. So when we left off at the midpoint of the season, we left Gina, who's the Stephanie Beatriz character, BoJack's former co-star, was trying to rebuild her career after he, you know, basically physically assaulted her on a set during a scene while being on drugs and was having a hard time and being labeled difficult. And that was unfortunately very of our time, which is something that BoJack, I think, has done a good job repositioning itself. I would say particularly starting with season 5, where the first several seasons were very good. It was like a kind of obviously the story of a very bad guy in Hollywood, but then as current events sort of changed where the narrative needed to go, it responded and kind of organized those in a way that made more sense narratively, and that continues. So she was trying to continue with her career, getting labeled difficult, as I said. She's up for a job, and her current director like kind of spikes her for it. So that's where we leave her. Hollyhock, his sister, is, as the credits roll on that last episode of the semi-season, about to hear how BoJack took a girl to prom, gave her booze, got her so drunk that she got alcohol poisoning, and then dumped her off at the ER and left without seeing what happened to her. So we pick up from there. Now he's teaching at Wesleyan, which is where Hollyhock goes. He's teaching acting, and she's, you know, kind of cold to him, and he doesn't know why, and she's not saying, and that's awkward for them. So it's always been interesting to me, as I said, particularly of recent years, how it portrays a story of male misconduct from both sides, in that it has empathy for BoJack. He's the protagonist, and it takes into account, you know, the fucked up childhood and conditioning and the real addiction issues that have gotten him where he is as an adult, but also emphasizes how for the women who are his victims, the idea of the abuse defining them forever afterwards is a secondary trauma that they also suffer, and also how any one of us at this point could recite the crisis management script for a story like BoJack's breaking, which is what happens in this last half of the season. We also reconnect with Diane, although she's not in the season very much, and in an episode that kind of parallels the one that was in the first half of the season about Princess Carolyn and her first days of single working motherhood, where it kind of really used the animation to good effect to depict like just the stress of it and how relentless it is. We get to see Diane working on her memoir and you know, hating herself and working on drafts and all of her self-doubt working themselves into it. And it's very funny. And how she figures out that writing about it isn't what makes your personal trauma worth experiencing. I'm doing air quotes too. And that the fact that it's hard doesn't mean that you have to do it. That's not, you know, your psyche signaling that means it's working, or it's the challenge is what makes it worthwhile. The other funny thing that happens is Mr. Peanut Butter writes a memoir and then tells Diane obliviously how easy it was. She just has to grit her teeth and is like, great. But to get back to the addiction, last week on the excellent Citations Needed podcast, they did an episode titled, in their typical even-handed way, JK, The Cruel Voyeuristic Quackery of Rehab TV Shows. And they talk about how rock bottom is only a useful concept narratively, because if you hit yours and then you relapse, then there was another rock bottom for you. And that's a concept that BoJack has to think about in this run of episodes also. There's also the matter that no one really knows what's the appropriate punishment for a person like BoJack who finally gets caught for years of misconduct. Except me, I know the answer is put them in a lead jumpsuit and shoot them out of a cannon into the sea. Just kidding. Not really. But anyway, As an animated show with a somewhat elastic reality, BoJack has a lot of freedom to imagine justice in this particular story, and I think that where it goes with it will satisfy viewers. I was satisfied, and I also, here is my plug, wrote about it for Vanity Fair, and we will link that in the show notes. So if you have watched the whole season, because it's obviously very spoily, you can go there and read my thoughts on that.
All right, Eve, what do you got?
I want to talk about HBO Sunday nights. I don't know, maybe people still watch TV live. I happened to do it a couple of weeks ago, and it's weird when you sit down and you're like, okay, so I'm supposed to watch Avenue 5, then Curb Your Enthusiasm, then The Outsiders, and then go to bed and go to work the next day, for real. So I know that Tara has already talked about Avenue 5 on this podcast. I concur with her assessment of it. It's not Veep, and, you know, I don't know why they keep trying to trick us into thinking it is. And it just feels like sort of sour. And I don't think that anybody really needs more stories about incompetent white men in positions of power while women of color do all the work. It's, am I supposed to be amused by that? I mean, that's a documentary. But Avenue 5 just sort of starts off this sort of 2-hour rock block of cranky old white man shows. The next show's Curb Your Enthusiasm. I guess I haven't watched Curb Your Enthusiasm in a while, so I don't know if it's changed or I have. I feel like the last time I watched it, it was more about, like, Larry's the only guy who really speaks the truth in an absurd world. And yeah, he's kind of rude, but, you know, he has his head on straight and everybody else is sort of silly. Now he just sort of seems unwell. A running plot point this season is that Larry is, air quotes, mistakenly called out for workplace harassment. But you guys, part of the harassment claim is how he cleans his glasses on an assistant's shirt, which she is wearing. That is literally harassment, or at least it's that thing like in Knives Out when Don Johnson just sort of hands his plate to Marta while he's talking. It's that sort of shit. And I'm not... I have no interest in being like, oh no, poor Larry. Oh my gosh, you know what? Women reporting harassment is actually hilarious. This Sunday's episode, I think I might be done with Curb Your Enthusiasm after it. It was nice to see Laverne Cox. She's great. But everything else about it, it just wasn't funny. It just wasn't funny. It's done for me. And, you know, I think people who are like, oh, you just don't get it. You have no sense of humor. No, I do have a sense of humor. I know it's funny. It's not fucking funny. And this season, Larry is opening a coffee shop next to Mocha Joe's just to sort of fuck with Mocha Joe. As a person who watches The Prophet and owns a business, I'm vaguely interested in that plot, but not enough to like sit through all this. Like the idea of Larry having to serve customers, I am sort of interested in that, but not enough to watch it. But I want to talk about The Outsider mainly, because that's new. It's a sort of supernatural dead kids in the wood drama. Dead kids are always in the woods. The woods are a terrible place for kids. It's it's based on a Stephen King novel from a couple of years ago, which I hadn't heard of because it just seems like Stephen King just keeps writing books and I don't know, they get sold at Target or something. I think we all know that Stephen King isn't the greatest when it comes to people of color or with people who are neuroatypical. And so like under his lens in both cases, these folks are best case scenario magical and the way that they are, and once again I'm using this as quotes, like they're sort of more in touch with the natural world or whatever. Typically people who are neuroatypical or not white are the ones who explain to the white people sort of the more fantastical elements of a Stephen King story for whatever reason. Great examples are, you know, sort of the television adaptation of The Stand or obviously, you know, The Shining or Dr. Sleep. So King's book was adapted by Richard Price for HBO. Price, who is, as far as I know, a white American, has a decent enough track record when it comes to writing about non-white folks. His novel Clockers, for example, was solid enough that he and Spike Lee co-wrote the film adaptation for it. So, you know, you'd think that he kind of knows what he's doing, but here we have a show set just outside of Atlanta in which almost every main character is a white person. That accepts one, a black woman who is clearly coded as being on the autism spectrum to like an almost Rain Man level. Well, Avenue 5, like, sort of didn't stand a chance, and I expect Larry David's been rich and famous for far too long to have the self-awareness to see that his outrageousness is curdled. I keep thinking about the squandered promise of The Outsider. The cast is remarkable. Ben Mendelsohn is great, as he always is, as a middle-aged white man. Jason Bateman has a really wild arc on the show. And Julianne Nicholson, who I liked so much on Law & Order Criminal Intent, she was a Megan Wheeler, if you remember, like, her seasons. She's raw and lovely, and the great Cynthia Erivo is absolutely fucking wasted as a magic N-word crossed with a magical R-word.
Ooh.
I didn't read King's novel, so I don't know how slavishly the show was adapted. So I'm kind of blaming King without verifying that he created such a lily-white world. Yet at the same time, I feel confident in my guess. Whatever the case, HBO just proved with Watchmen that a primarily Caucasian text can be transformed into a series in which race is more than shorthand for knowing all the different words for scary and evil entities. That said, I'm still watching The Outsider because the plot is just weird enough that I want to see how the showrunners write their way out of it. But if the retrograde character notes for the single non-white main character are any indication, my hopes probably shouldn't be that high.
This is the show with Ben Mendelsohn that we watched.
Yeah, yes? We watched the first one.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, did you guys watch it?
Just the first one.
I watched the first one, did not care for it. Was interested enough to see what I thought was a supernatural tinge plot, where it went. So I read the book synopsis and I'm like, well,
nope.
I'm good.
Uncle Stevie has, you know, there's like an old man performative wokeness on Twitter thing happening that I can't imagine doesn't bleed into his scripted works. So that I was the same as Dave. Read the synopsis and was like, that's going to annoy me. Not doing it.
Yeah, I see. I think Stephen King and Larry David probably have a lot in common in that they have now been rich and separated from the rest of us far longer than they were poor, yet they still believe that they know how the rest of us live.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yep.
Battle Angel Alita all over again with our floating cities of a movie I just watched a couple days ago. What do you got to plug there, Eve?
Oh, yeah. So as we've already mentioned a few times, Sarah and I write a newsletter called Best Evidence. Ooh. You can find it at bestevidence.fyi, where we talk about, like we did today, what true crime is worth your time. We talk about Sarah's podcast, The Blotter Presents, and we sort of keep everyone abreast of the true crime cases that perhaps they got engaged in while watching a true crime property. Like right now, when it's, you know, sort of necessary, I can't do it all the time, we'll mention important things that are happening in the Weinstein case, because we've obviously written about Catch and Kill and other ways that the story's sort of been presented. We also do a lot of roundups of true crime podcasts to check out, great crime long reads, and talk about just how true crime is presented in the world today. So it's not just like, you know, Sarah and I are opening up a box of wine and writing like, so here's what we think about this thing. We're talking about...
Speak for yourself.
Oh, box of wine, Sarah. I can send you some stuff. But we're not just talking about the case and like, ooh, it's weird, it's scary, I'm into true crime. But we're talking about the sort of the next step of it, how it's being presented and how it's being sold. And,
yeah, it's great.
So, yeah, thank you, Tara. Tara thank is a subscriber.
Thank you, Tara.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, so The Good Place finally wrapped it up. This last season, and to be honest, most of the prior season were a chore to get through. Like, it was literally on my to-do list as a chore. After a while, it really started to feel like various resets were happening just to fuck with us, and that various, all of a sudden they would just be in a new setting with the new set of rules, and it was just very like, and you know, Poochie went back to The Good Place, like, okay. I mean, that's not like the sort of epistemological rigor is not why I watch the show. If that's why you watch the show, I hope you were content. But it's like, okay, it's all the little jokes about like the chowder fountain and Blake Bortles and stuff like that, and a lot of the stuff that a lot of the stuff that people complained about was not like that wasn't an issue for me, but it really seemed to take a long time to get where it was going. I'm sure I'm not the only critic who thought that relying on Chidi and Eleanor's so-called great love as a world-saving plot engine did not really work. I love both these actors. Their chemistry was not.
Oh, thing. Every time they kissed, it closed up down there for me. I mean, yeah.
They're like brother and sister. Like they're just not. They're not hot. They're not. They don't. They are not believable. And I feel like that's true across every Mike Schur show, frankly.
Well, and I think Mike Schur shows also sometimes like there's a elemental sentimentality that he keeps in check until he doesn't have to.
Yeah. Mm.
Which is a reason that I've been warned not to watch Parks and Rec, that they're like, the balance is way off and you won't like it.
Yep.
True.
True.
I've observed that warning, but motherfucker, I sobbed during Chidi's speech about waves going back into the ocean. And also every single time Janet came up to that bench in the forest and gave her little remarks, weeping all over again. I don't know if that was the show successfully manipulating me or me just like being in a space where this kind of contemplation of mortality and saying goodbye, that I was just like, well, finally, Dan's like, have you been complaining about this show for like a year and a half? Like, you're crying, fuck off. So that was my reaction to the finale. I'm glad they folded the tents. I was successfully manipulated.
I like all of these actors. I like all these people. I think that guy who plays Jason is a fucking dreamboat.
Oh my God.
And I can't wait to see what he, oh God, when he had his hair like parted in that one episode where he had to go back. Oh my God. I want to see these people do something else now, because all of this, the whole time it was just so cartoony. They were so stuck in this one sort of like meh, meh, meh thing. I'm glad it's done.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was time to go, and they went.
Yeah, I agree. Manny Jacinto is super Fox, and the next thing you can see him in is the Top Gun sequel movie that also stars my other fave, Glenn Powell, so funny in Scream Queens, so look for that. But yeah, I mean, I've been bitching about the show probably since season two and somehow kept watching it, I guess, because Dave was. I probably would have bailed if not for Dave.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
Sorry.
It's fine. But yeah, I don't know why they kept it was so protracted.
The show has like this fractal reset rate that was maddening, because the first season was like so good. And
yes,
that sense of exploration of a place you've never been and the weird rules and what's actually happening. You know, for the longest time, I thought the whole thing was the bad place for Michael. That was going to be the reveal, that this is actually punishment for something he did. That's why everything was sort of working wrong. It could have been. It would have made just as much sense as what came later.
Yes.
But then like they kept on resetting the world. And that's when it sort of became like less funny within the context of their made up afterlife. And then it just sort of like the rules of the afterlife and ping pong of players going back and forth and having successes and troubles, just like it took the energy out of it.
Yeah.
And when you reset characters, literally reset them and make them have amnesia every other episode, like you can't help but lose momentum.
Yeah.
Like that was good once, right? You can do that once, but to do it over and over again, just at a certain point, you're really diminishing returns, right?
Yeah.
You're diminishing returns at an accelerated rate.
Yeah.
By the end of it, I was like, this show kind of isn't funny anymore. And the sentimentality isn't clicking with me because I have a cold black heart and that stuff is not what attracts me. Like, well, you know, it's not the same thing as season one. So be it.
Here's the problem for me. Definitely that's part of it. But the other thing is that like, it was a kind of, it was an interesting idea. It was like a sort of defending your life kind of thing with this underpinning of like, we read some philosophy and we're going to work it in. And then it became this like critical mass consensus where it's like, it's brilliant how it works it in. And then it's like, oh no, now it's going to be all about that all the time. And then by the end, it was just like, stop smelling your own farts. I don't care. If I wanted to read these books, I would fucking read them. Like BoJack Horseman.
Spoilers ahoy.
BoJack Horseman ends at the same place too, with like Diane and BoJack, spoiler, having a conversation about like, you know, maybe it was my job to like look out for you. Maybe it's everyone's job to look out for everyone else. And it's like, it was just such a more elegant way to get there. Like BoJack isn't a perfect show either. And like, I certainly grant that it's not for everyone, but it's like, and there are certainly an argument to be made that it's up its own ass in some ways too, but like The Good Place was just so pleased with itself, like in a way that was so off-putting.
If you say
me.
That BoJack Horseman is up its own ass, at least it was that formula from the beginning.
Yeah, yes.
Well, and don't take the edge off Kristen Bell. Like, that's just, I don't think yes. that was the play. I like everything Mike Schur has ever done, except Parks and Rec, which I haven't watched and won't. Sometimes the balance is just out of whack. That's what I thought. With that said, if he wanted to make me bawl with the finale, he succeeded. So I guess he left it in a good place.
Segway!
For my blog, I have two true crime reviews of recent docuseries properties. On primetimer.com. One of them is about Ted Bundy falling for a killer, which we're also talking about on The Blotter Presents this week with Stephanie Early Green. And one is about I Am a Killer season 2, which is one of those like the title is too vague and sounds real trashy. And then you sit with it and you're like, oh, this is really an interesting, like, this is a true document of death row inmates. And in season 2, they have some ladies join the roster. So I recommend it. The creator of the show was pretty pleased about that on Twitter. I guess he didn't expect anybody to watch it. Once again, both of those pieces are on primetimer.com.
The show I'm talking about is Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet. So this is a show that is about video game developers. It sort of presents as Silicon Valley light with some office ossity mixed in. People that are involved also created It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. This is nothing like that.
Yeah, it's for sure closer to Silicon Valley than that.
So one of the guys from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Rob McElhenney?
McElhenney.
He plays the creative director for this video game company. His name is Ian Grimm. And then there is a lead programmer named Poppy Lee. She's Australian, played by Charlotte Nakado?
Nick Dow, I think.
Nick Dow. And then there's a bunch of supporting people. We got F. Murray Abraham as this like 70s kind of one hit wonder. He got one award in his life, sci-fi author, still mm-hmm. sort of trapped in the late 70s, early 80s when he had a taste of success. He is supposed to be this video game world's writer. This video game is sort of like a World of Warcraft-esque, massively multiplayer online game. You got David Hornsby. That was the guy who played Cricket from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He plays the office manager.
He's the executive producer.
Oh, okay.
And he co-created the show.
And you got Danny Pudi. He's the chief of monetization, which is an actual role that now mm-hmm. exists in video game companies. I think everybody listening probably played a mobile game here and there. If you ever got annoyed by artificial time limits on your game and having to buy more coins or stars, that is this guy's job. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. does translate into bigger video games, such as World of Warcraft, where you can buy armor for your horse for a dollar and all that kind of stuff. There's some good chemistry between some of the pairings here. Like Ian and Poppy have a good relationship. You know, he is this pie in the sky creative director, doesn't have to worry about anything has to be implemented because it's Poppy's problem and Poppy's always living in his shadow. That's the dynamic there. C.W. Longbottom, who's a 70s sci-fi author, sort of like sidles in and out of everybody's work life in this just really weird kind of half their way, which is like
it comes out that he lives like in a closet at the office. Yeah. Like no one is supposed to talk about it. He's like a drunk.
And there's this crazy pants assistant named Joe who likes to like throw gas on everybody's fire. It's kind of an amusing character in small doses.
Yeah.
The biggest issue I have with this show, though, is that it wants to tell some real human stories, but it can't manage those stories within the framework that they established for the show.
Yeah.
I'll give you two examples. There's video game testers in a room named Rachel and Dana, and they have this flirty, who's going to have the courage to ask the other one out first storyline for the first few episodes. But it feels like that whole storyline and the dialogue was like lifted from a freeform show and then
totally
plopped into this. Like it yeah. doesn't mesh with the comedy that they're doing. And there's no reason why it shouldn't.
Yeah.
Like there's a comedy to be had in that and it doesn't really happen. The mm-hmm. other example is a If These Walls Could Talk, totally separate episode about what happened to a different company that worked in the same building once upon a time. Mm-hmm. I don't know what show that's from, but it's not this show. Like, it was okay on its surface as a standalone thing. It wasn't great. It wasn't so epically fantastic that it deserved to be this whole separate thing with a whole separate tone, a right. whole separate color palette. Like, it was so different. Yeah.
It's also funny because one of the characters is played by Jake Johnson, and it's clear, like, even though it starts in like 1993, he was like, all right, I'll do it, but I'm not going to cut my hair or shave. Like, he looks exactly like he does on Stumptown. Yeah. It's like, okay, fine. Like, no, very low effort cameo for old JJ.
Yeah.
Proceed, Dave.
So that's my big issue, is that they just like haven't figured out the way to say all the things they want to say while still being sort of sharp and funny about it. It's not a dramedy, so you can't really do that. It's a comedy, so, yeah. I mean, you can do it, but it's herky-jerky.
This is the problem, that because it's an Apple TV Plus show, they obviously got their whole order at once. And if it had been a situation where there was like, all right, make six, and then we'll see how it goes, I feel like they could have made the whole arc for the season way tighter, and they could have worked out some of these tone problems for a stronger season two, which, like, I assume this is coming back for season two, because, like, it's Apple TV Plus, everything is coming back for season two. Right. But I think there's something here, yeah. and I think that they will find it yeah. as they go forward, but it is very flabby for a first season, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, it's enjoyable. There's some funny stuff in it. There's some stuff like Silicon Valley that pulls directly from the industry, although one did annoy me. And this is a spoiler, so if you're going to watch it, move ahead. But there's an episode in the story, Nazis come in and start using it. You know, they're playing the game, but they're also using it as a tool for communication and blah, blah, blah. So the company finds out about this, and they're trying to figure out how to fix it because they start to get bad press about it. And ultimately, their solution is something called shadow banning, which is something that happens, but not in this context. Eventually, what they do is get all the Nazis so that they just play on their own server without their knowledge, which the show seems pretty happy about, but it's such a bad solution.
Right.
Like, you cut it out and you throw it away. Like, when all that shit was happening with Stormer, what's the SS site? Daily
Stormfront? Daily Stormer.
The Daily Stormer. Yeah.
Yeah. When all that stuff was going on with that, Cloudflare, the company, said, no, fuck yeah. Boom. Out. Like, because you're terrible people.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a gray area the further away you get from pure Nazis. But I think for pure Nazis, you can say, guys, we're going to kick you out.
Yeah.
This show does the shadow banning. And shadow banning is sort of like a thing you do when you have cheaters in your game that right. use. So, you know, you're playing a shooter and somebody can headshot you 100% of the time because they got a cheat going. You can keep on banning those people one by one as you find out about them, you know, and then they'll just create a new account and come back in and do it again. Or you shadow ban them when they don't know, but turns out they're in a server full of people that are doing exactly the same thing because they're all cheaters. So you just got all the cheaters playing each other.
Yeah.
So show to them. So that I found wasn't pitch perfect. Mm-hmm. Like they made a mistake there. But, you know, it's enjoyable, but it's atonal. It's good, not great. The Apple TV Plus story. It is time for the canon, the extra hot great Hall of Fame for episodes of TV shows. Presenting this week, Eve Beatty. Take it away, Eve.
Hi, folks. This week, I am presenting for your consideration Home Movies, Season 4, Episode 1, which is entitled Everyone's Entitled to My Opinion. I sort of assume that everybody who's listening to the show, this was before I knew you had like 600 people on, you know, Patreon or however you say it alone. So probably way more people listen to this than I thought. But anyway, I was sort of operating the assumption that most folks who are listening are familiar with Home Movies. It's a late 90s, early aughts animated series that shares a load of DNA with Bob's Burgers. Both were created by Lauren Bouchard and include vocal talent from a lot of the same folks, most notably probably H. John Benjamin. So if there was opposition to the inclusion of Home Movies in the canon as a show, this is my fear of that 70s showing, you guys. The fact that without it, there might not even be a Bob's Burgers might quash that. But that's all straw man. I know that Home Movies has already made it into the canon. Monty successfully pitched Bye Bye Gracie back in 2017. So now I have to explain to you guys why that episode isn't sufficient. And why Everyone's Entitled to My Opinion should also be included in your list. So my primary argument is this. On November 11th, 2003, that's when this show aired, this episode aired, Home Movies character Melissa took up a battle that we are all still fighting today. Clip one, please, Dave.
You know, Brendan, you don't have to say www anymore.
What? Why?
You can just say the website name without the www.
No, 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 no. That's how you type it in, Melissa. www.
I know, that's how you type it, but you don't have to say it. If you said to me moviewienerwinner.com, I would know what you meant without the www.
So no W's ever.
Okay, Brendan, for the sake of this conversation, what? You don't have to say www because I know what it is, okay? And so does the rest of the world.
Folks, when I was watching a movie yesterday morning when I was typing this up, a TV station that is literally based in Silicon Valley used www to describe the website for which I work. I would have angrily tweeted at them if I didn't think that that would make me seem as bad as Brendan, the 8-year-old protagonist of this show, who in this episode has gotten a gig as a reviewer at what appears to be a website reliant on user-generated content. That's my second argument for this show's inclusion, its precognitive nature. While in 2003, website owners big and small were, it's true, starry-eyed at the possibility that content created by passionate users would lead to big bucks. Most of these sites, I think that we can agree, including whatever caused the sort of direct inspiration for movie winnerwiener.com, most of them are lost to everything but the Wayback Machine. But there is one site based solely on opinions that's risen to rule them all, and that's Yelp. That's right. Brendan, whether he knew it or not, is a Yelp elite, though Yelp wouldn't launch until July of the following year. But look at the intentionally hacky way his reviews are composed. It doesn't summon any sort of long-ago community-driven pop culture sites as much as it does reviews penned by Yelpers who fancy themselves artists. And Brendan, an 8-year-old filmmaker, definitely considers himself a creative type. Speaking of his movies, here's a bit from the film he's making during this episode, which stars Melissa and their friend Jason. Clip two, please.
How can you not have an opinion on anything?
I don't know.
What do you think of my new earring?
I don't know.
Well, then what do you think of my new hat?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? You have to have an opinion.
No, I can't. Nobody cares what I think.
Well, that may be true, but you should still have an opinion.
You want my opinion?
Yes.
This sucks.
See? Wait, that's not in the script.
I'm talking about the script, Melissa. It sucks.
You're right. Brendan, you have to fix this.
Yeah, it's stupid.
Yeah, but hold on in a minute, guys.
So this brings me to my third reason for canon inclusion. That is how deftly this episode illustrates the way men use a combination of mansplaining and deliberate fatigue to shoot down the reasonable points of a woman in their midst. I'll let the third clip, which also includes Jason, Melissa, and Brendan, make my point.
You're writing a review for www.moviewiener.com.
You guys, you don't have to say www.
But yet,
I don't want to have this conversation again.
What are you talking about, Melissa?
You have to say it, Melissa. You got to say it.
You don't, because everyone knows what it means.
How do you know it's a website?
Because you say .com.
Yeah, but how do you know
it's
not
just... How do you know it's www?
Yeah, how do you know that's a good point?
Because it's just one of those things that when something's around for a long enough time in society, you can just abbreviate it.
Like what else?
Like what? Like
names?
What
else for like...
Names of
people? That's what I was...
All right, you know what? Say www. I don't care.
No, you know what I'm saying.
No, forget it. You're right. In fact, don't say www. Say World Wide Web every time you say a website.
Oh, that's a total waste.
That's a waste of time.
Listen, I know. I'm hung up on this www thing. Some of this could be my baggage, which I won't bore you with. Let's just say I am Melissa, and I expect all of you on the panel today, even Dave, who is a yucky boy, have been at one point or another Melissa as well. Finally, this episode provides a great example of how dense, fast, and elegant the jokes on this show can be. Depending on what sources you consult, Home Movies is either almost completely improvised or is completely and carefully scripted. Like most tightly constructed shows, I suspect that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. To illustrate that, I've chosen a scene in which Brendan, Melissa, and Jason are waiting for Coach McGurk. Imagine Archer if he drove a beater and was kind of a pathetic grade school soccer coach instead, to pick them up to take them to a screening of a movie that Brendan's set to review. Clip four, please.
I don't like this, Brendan.
Me neither, Brenda.
It's fine, guys. Don't worry
about it. Coach McGurk is late.
He'll be here.
Oh, I heard a long time ago that they found a head.
Jason, I don't want to hear that kind of stuff, okay?
Melissa, I was just going to say that they found a headlight.
Oh.
Next to a body.
Jason!
A dead body.
Stop it! Go ahead then, make jokes. But did you know that the teenagers come here to get drunk on Friday nights?
How do you know, Melissa?
My father buys for them.
That's illegal.
Well, he says they're just going to buy it in a couple years anyway. It makes sense when he says it.
Oh, now I know where to go.
Brendan, there's nothing worse than drunken teenagers.
Thanks to your dad.
Yeah.
We can't stay out here. We're going to be eaten by coyotes. And elk.
elk.
It's rutting season. They're extra dangerous during the rutting season.
Yeah, your father probably gives them alcohol.
Guys, quiet.
Shh.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Somebody's coming to kill us.
Oh, no. Melissa, it's a car full of elk.
Jason!
Who's there? Drunken teenagers?
I wish. Who doesn't love them? But come on, don't just stand there. Get in. It's rutting season.
Yeah, there's an edge to home movies, but it's certainly not, say, Veep. There's a heart and warmth to it, even though it's occasionally crass. In conclusion, which I am saying at the end of my review because that is how it is done, Brendan, I believe that this episode deserves canon inclusion because not only does it have classic home movies elements like a drunk McGurk, but it shows special above-the-pack characteristics, including incisive social commentary, a precognitive look at user-gen review culture, and most importantly, it threw a mighty blow against continuing to say www before the name of a website. Perhaps, if this episode is added to the canon, this episode will settle the matter completely and we can move on to those people who insist on saying blog when they mean blog post.
Yes!
Oh! Thank you all for your time and attention.
Go ahead and cross that out of my notes because last thing I said. I don't know if Sarah should go first or last because we watch the show and she doesn't.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, let Sarah go first.
Okay.
The newcomer perspective.
Well, I mean, just based on the blog post thing, obviously it's a yes from me. See also my parents' friends thinking that I owned and then sold Rotten Tomatoes for a gazillion dollars. Sure. That's why I'm wearing this sweater from 2005. This was a delight. I'm so glad that you pulled that last clip because I like watched that sequence again because it was so dense. Just like the mental imagery of like drunk elk and Jason is always my favorite. Just like that sort of snuffly way that he says the most biting shit. I totally wanted to keep watching, which is a canon criterion for Bunsy. There's also that whole subplot with interim principal Lynch, mm-hmm. where he's like Mr. Interim Principal Lynch. It's
interim!
Really funny.
Interim.
I heard that bastard. It's like it's just really good. And then the little tag at the end where he realizes that he's in like school administrator's magazine or whatever, and he's thrilled, even though they called him Mr. Lunch. This was just really fun. It was a delightful 22 minutes. I laughed many times, and it's a fucking blog post, and I've been screaming about this for almost 20 years. thank you for bringing this to us, and also, what a efficient presentation. Okay. Well done. So, A+ from Interim Lynch over here. Tara or Dave, who's next?
I'll go next. I won't focus on the fact that Brendan is getting paid for his reviews, roughly what some bloggers still get paid 20 years later to write.
Oh, yeah, totally. When they said $75, I was like, yeah, as if. But when he started, he was doing it for free, and then they started to pay him. So
right.
I sort of vagued that up. Yeah.
Anyway, sob. We already talked about starting his review with In Conclusion, which is great. But there is certainly a lot to like in this episode. If Eve intended to choose one that borrowed the styling of Tony Soprano and Dr. Melfi in the movie within the show in order to court Sarah, very wise. I certainly clocked that. I assume Sarah did too. Oh, and I also, this time, because I hadn't watched home movies in a while, was struck by the fact that the spirit of Coach McGurk lives on in Coach Steve of Big Mouth, although Coach Steve is, you know, maybe a little further down.
Yeah, a little less gray matter and
chromosomally than Coach McGurk. But there is definitely a lot to like in this episode. The problem with home movies is that, like, every episode is so good that as much as I enjoyed watching this and watching it again, and like the get in running season was definitely very good.
It was a nice piece of business.
It's
There's no
really,
other way to say that.
It's very good. Yeah. Like the deftness with which all of that was, that whole sequence was written. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so.
It's my favorite part of this episode.
Not a moment wasted. Like, yeah. It's just so elegant. But the problem is home movies is so good all the way through. Like, I don't know if this one really sticks out for me as a canon contender. Dave.
The episode opens up with a little conversation between Brendan and Melissa. And it turns out they're having this conversation sitting on grass in the middle of a soccer game they're supposed to be participating in. And this is when the first WWW conversation takes place. And I feel like WWW is sort of like, it's going to have that same weight and significance as like Klondike 5-3000. Like it's like, what the hell is that? Why did they need to? And then at the assembly where everybody's learning about the interim principle, it's worth mentioning that the twins that constantly correct him that he's interim and not the real principal. It's funny to think that they were just like directly wholesale lifted to be on Bob's Burgers as the Pesto twins, right? Pesto twins?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The review writing in this, I was having trouble figuring out what it, but you're so right. Serious, way into it, Yelp reviews. You absolutely nailed that, Eve.
So, in conclusion, yes. Yes, I know it's a funny way to start a review, but as far as I'm concerned. As far as I'm concerned, there is no argument. Helium Buffoon is a funny, smart, clever, hilarious, feel-good, high-energy tearjerker that takes us on a crazy edge-of-your-seat ride through the world of balloon delivery guys and turns it into a crazy world of buffoon delivery guys when Jeb suddenly has to take over the business. Yeah.
The self-satisfaction at the end kind of tells you everything you need to know about what they were going for there. I got one more review clip. I'll just play it now.
The suspense was suspenseful and the comedy was funny. But Movie Guy says, read the book instead. The phone book, that is, because it has less characters than this movie.
And then there's the opinion movie shoot, which is actually called Opinion, Where Art Thou? According to the script cover we see. There is a really dumb joke in the middle of the reshoots for Opinion, Where Art Thou?
I wasn't trying to insult you, Doctor. I'm just saying that with a name like Schfoot and Mouser, I didn't...
You didn't think I'd be Irish, did ya?
I don't know why I found that funny, but it does.
Are you a leprechaun?
Yeah. So good. But my main problem with this episode, as far as dealing it with the canon, is that from this point, almost to the end, there's a lull here. And it lasts for about a third of the episode where nothing really engaging happens until towards the end, where we get into the kids waiting for McGurk to pick up, which is that whole scene with the elk and whatnot. That sort of empty period right there, I feel like, makes it different than some of the other strong contenders of this series. A couple other mentions. The movie that Brendan needs to review that Coach McGurk is going to drive him to is called All That Violence, which I think is kind of funny.
And would watch.
At the end, McGurk is watching the film. And if you pause it, you can see all the credits for it. So we had Tom and Penelope Coos and Kiefer Sutherland as some of the credits.
Oh, God. This is not a children's show.
Not a children's show. I think that this episode has a lot of good stuff to recommend it. But I do think home movies, first of all, I'll argue that I don't think home movies is great every episode. I don't think it's that kind of show. Because I remember being bored by a lot of episodes that they were sort of low key. Like I can pinpoint the highlights of the show, episodes that were sort of above and beyond.
All
like
right.
Starboy, like Coach McGurk's car
yeah.
musical. And the episodes that managed to be stem to stern, packed, engaged, funny, I feel like this episode doesn't quite hit that mark because of this one third of it where it sort of dips and it doesn't really run on all cylinders at that point. There's no clunkers in home movies, but I do think there are A tier and B tier episodes. Mm. And this is sort of like right in the middle of A tier and B tier for me. So
fair enough.
With that, shall we put it to the final vote?
Sure.
Sarah D. Bunting, sounded like you enjoy it. What say you?
Yeah, I don't have the context to know any better, so it's a yay for me.
Tara Ariana?
It's a regretful no, but thank you for the presentation.
Yeah, and it's a marginal no for me, but don't let that dissuade you from watching home movies. It is definitely a good show.
And it's all on the Adult Swim app.
So, guys, that means home movies. Season 4, Episode 1. Everyone's titled to my opinion. You are hereby not inducted into the extra. Oh, great kid.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser Leak. Tara has our winner.
I do. At the WGA Awards last week, this is, of course, the Writers Guild of America. One of the categories is Outstanding Variety Sketch Show, one of the nominees, Saturday Night Live, and of course, probably a heavy favorite, They do a lot of cameos. They have these cold opens that are very current eventsy that people supposedly like.
And people that actually don't watch any of the nominees at least know that from the buzzy next day clips that everybody shares on Twitter and whatnot. Yeah.
Indeed. And yet, SNL did not win the winner in that category. I think you should leave with Tim Robinson. And when I read that, I was like,
what?
That's all. Congratulations, Tim Robinson's great show. Can't
well
wait
deserved.
For season two.
One of the best shows of last year.
Oh my God, 100%.
Yeah. All right, and now we move on to our loser,
Stinky.
Yeah.
So, who's our loser?
Our loser is Terry Crews, who finally apologized to Gabrielle Union for not having her back over her accusations against America's Got Talent executives. I mean, at least he did it, but like of all people to hear, to hear this colleague be like, yeah, there was bias there, and to be like, that wasn't my experience, shrug emoji,
yeah,
is disappointing. So he finally did apologize, but, and he didn't, I'm sorry you feel that way. I'll give him that.
Yeah. But it took he like the entire apologized. Internet yelling at him for him to do it. So
yeah, and it was like 3 weeks ago too. So come on, yeah.
Speaking about the entire internet yelling at you, do you know what time it is?
Yes. Yelling time.
Daytime.
This is the 10th game time of the season. Scores are: Sarah on the precipice of a season victory with 4 wins.
Oh, God.
Value Guess with 2 wins, and Tara Ariano also with 2 wins. Today we are playing TV Crossword from Mr. Dan Cassino.
Damn you, Cassino!
Who earns himself an extra credit for a topic of his choosing. Now, in this game, we are going to be filling in a TV crossword puzzle. All the answers are names of popular TV shows. I am going to tell you how many letters are in the answer and what letter it starts with.
Oh, man.
And a clue that corresponds to the name of the show, but has nothing to do with the show context itself.
Got it.
Okay. That is answerable for 2 points. If you're still stumped, I'll give you a second clue, which has something about the show itself in it.
Okay.
Correct answer at that point is worth 1 point.
Okay.
Since we're working in pen, you only get one answer. So choose your clues and the time you answer carefully.
Got it.
Gotcha.
So here's an example. I might tell you that this show is from Premium Cable, is 9 letters long, and begins with an L. Your first clue would be traditional Thanksgiving meal. Your second clue would be dour after rapture.
Leftovers.
The answer is Leftovers, which brings up my other point. We will lose definite articles here and there.
Okay.
Now, we have 36 questions, we have a tiebreaker, and remember, you only get one shot at the answer.
Understood.
Steel meal situation, please, Dara.
Thank you, Dave. I have 1 steel meal and 1 extravaganza gong. Sarah D. Bunting has 0 steel meals. Value guess, of course, have been Reinwell Jones.
Oh, Reinwell Jones. This is tragedy. Nick.
Before we begin, since we have 36 questions, can I go pee?
Oh, sure. All right, let's throw it to Picky to see who will play first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, our order today, Tara, Eve, Sarah, are we ready to play TV Crossword?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right, it's time for round one. All the answers are premium TV.
Okay.
Tara,
mm-hmm.
5 letters, starts with G. Who run the world?
Girls.
That's how you do it. Eve Beatty, that's worth 2 points, Tara.
Yes, thank you.
Eve Beatty. 5 letters, starts with B. Singers White or Manilow, for instance.
Barry.
That's worth 2 points.
Textbook.
Sarah D. Bunting. 9 letters, starts with E. P. Diddy's includes his valet, Fonsworth Bentley.
Entourage.
Entourage is correct. Back to Tara.
Umbrella holder. Yep.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's what he does?
Mm-hmm.
How much do you think he gets paid for that?
I mean, like 6 figures. He doesn't do it anymore.
Wow. That's amazing.
Did he get benefits? Was it 401k?
His benefit was hanging out with P. Diddy, Eve.
Wow. That is like the poster for Stupid Rich. Amazing. Yeah. Tara Ariano, we're back to you.
Yes,
Eight letters starts with S. So remind you, these are premium TV shows.
Yes.
Eight letters starts with S. High-end singers.
Sopranos.
Eve. Six letters starts with D. That's right in Latin.
The next hint, please.
All right, here's our first second hint. He's a lumberjack, but he's not okay. Any idea what that six-letter D show on premium TV is? That's right in Latin. He's a lumberjack, but he's not okay.
Oh, God, I'm going to hate myself when you tell me the answer. I don't know.
All right. No steel meals, but I feel like maybe Tara knows.
Yeah, it's Dexter.
Dexter, which is the Latin word for right, as opposed to
left. I didn't know that. Now I know.
Yeah, that was the part I knew.
Extra hot, great. Expanding your mind. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, nine letters, starts with an S. Your first clue. A lot of people claimed to be him and get hung up on it.
Get hung up on it. I don't know. Can I have a hint?
Stars is, that's with a Z, Sword and Sandal Saga.
Sword and Sandal Saga? Suitlander? I don't know.
Incorrect. Anybody know it?
Spartacus.
Claimed to be him. I am Spartacus et al. Tara.
Yep.
Eight letters. Starts with D. It really burns.
Proceed.
South Dakota set Western.
Oh, Deadwood.
Good for 1 point. Back to Eve. 13 letters starts with S. Where Californians make sand pay.
These are all one word answers, right?
Not necessarily.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
In crossword style, sometimes you got two words.
Right.
So let me read that again. 13 letters starts with S. Where Californians make sand pay.
Can I have the show hint, please?
Home of luckless Pied Pipers.
Silicon Valley.
Sand, yes.
Ah, right.
Sarah D. Bunter?
Have you met?
Sarah D. Bunting. Nine letters starts with O. Not from around here.
Outlander?
Good for two.
There she is.
All right, everybody, the last question of our first round coming at you. Tara?
Yep.
Eight letters starts with H. Where you come from, wherever you were born.
Oh, hint.
Showtime conspiracy thriller.
Homeland.
Eve Beatty. Mm-hmm. Eight letters starts with B. B as in boy. Part of an often imitated Carl Sagan quote.
Billions.
Billions and billions of stars. Correct. Last question of round one before we go into our score break. Seven letters for Sarah D. Bunting. Starts with the letter K. Jerks follow up to an offensive comment.
Jerks follow up to an offensive comment. I will need a hint.
Show where Frank Langella is Jim Carrey's dad.
Oh, fuck. How many letters again? I'm sorry.
Seven.
Kidding?
Yeah!
Oh,
kidding.
I was like, kid stuff with one F?
I was literally like a micron from buzzing on that one on the keyboard.
Wow.
All right, scores please, Sarah.
Gorgeous. Wow. Super close game. I have 6 points. Eve and Sarah are tied with 5 each.
Ooh, guess what that means? Cooperative gross work equalizer challenge.
Oh, yeah.
right. So you're going to work together and you will share the points. So if you get half of these questions right, you'll get 4 points in total. Share them two apiece.
Right.
Manage to get them all, you'll get 4 points apiece.
Good luck.
It is not too shabby. All right. To remind you, I'm holding in my hand a Trivial Pursuit card. It is from the mid-90s TV box. So answer appropriately. Here we go. Starting you off with the classics category. What presidential candidate's 1948 campaign promises included cut rate banana splits and one school day a year?
Sarah, you're the one who went to the fancy school. Who was running for president in 48?
I thought you were going to say you were alive in 1948.
Oh, no, I'm the oldest person here. I can't do that.
Old Lady Bunter.
One day of school a year? I mean, it's got to be some, like, cartoon character, but I don't know. I don't know who.
You want to hazard a guess, or are you just buzzy on this one?
Mickey Mouse.
Howdy Doody.
That fucker.
That fucker. Sitcoms. What was Lucy's last name on Here's Lucy?
You motherfuckers.
Was it... Okay, so our choices are Ricardo or Arnaz, right?
Yeah, I think it's Arnaz.
Right, that's her real last name.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Wrong show, guys. What? That was I Love Lucy. We're looking for Here's Lucy. Carter. Carter was the answer.
Carter?
Who the fuck is that?
Some broad.
Oh, like the cartoon Lucy?
Drama. What military outfit, what branch of the military, suspects that the A-team kept the loot for themselves after raiding the Bank of Hanoi?
So we're looking for a branch of the military?
What military outfit? Yeah, branch of the military.
It's the army, yeah?
Sure.
Hey!
Kids and Games? What the fuck? Who was... Who? It's always good. Always a good sign. Who was King Leonardo's beatnik brother? I don't know what that refers to.
King Leonardo's beatnik brother? This is in the mid-90s. None of these sound like they're from the mid-90s. How do you do these not mid-90s?
It was produced in the mid-90s. So you go mid-90s and backwards is your potential.
King Leonardo's beatnik brother.
I don't know. Professor Bop?
You're both wrong, of course, because, you know. What the hell is this? The answer, though, was Itchy. Itchy was King Leonardo's beatnik brother.
It was a show called King Leonardo and His Short Subjects.
All right.
Mm. Never heard of
Ew.
It.
Yeah, it probably lasted 22 years.
Yeah.
All right, you need both of these guys. Your next category is stars. What VH1 VJ's contract wasn't renewed soon after he began reading aloud on air from a John Cheever novel?
What?
Oh,
this is the thing?
Oh my god, that's badass.
I can't think of any VH1 VJs.
I can't either.
I can only think of MTV VJs.
Yeah. I have absolutely no idea. I'm sorry.
Did they poach Kurt Loder maybe? No.
Kurt Loder? What? No.
No. Also wrong.
We're looking for Bobby Rivers. Bobby Rivers.
Never
course,
heard
famous,
of this person.
Infamous.
That card sucks. Tear
Bobby
it up.
Rivers. All right. Sorry. That means you're not getting your additional points, but we're only one third of the way through. So we still got two thirds of this game to play. So shall we get back into it?
Yes.
Yes.
Excellent.
Round two, network dramas.
Okay. Network dramas. Got
network.
It. Got it. Got it. Yep.
Six letters.
Mm-hmm.
Starts with C.
Okay.
Shortcut that gets the king to safety.
I need a hint.
ABC show that spun off a series of novels.
Oh, Castle.
Castle. Shortcut that gets the king to safety.
In chess. Correct. Fucking crosswords.
Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Eight letters. Starts with H. Famous elephant mover.
Houdini.
Incorrect. What? We're looking for... Hannibal.
Oh, God.
Hannibal crosses the Alps crush. If you get that, I like you. All right, Sarah D. Bunting. 11 letters starts with Q. Major advance, especially for a physicist.
Quantum leap.
Sarah D. Bunting.
2 points. Tara.
Yes.
Nine letters.
Mm-hmm.
Starts with T. Mm-hmm. T as in Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
Castor and Pollux.
Yep.
In the Alps, for example.
Friend.
Quirky early 90s hit.
Oh, no. I should know this and I'm going to be mad, but I can't pull it.
Castor and Pollux in the Alps. Twin Peaks.
No!
All right. This is the next one's for Eve, and it is question 17. The
It's
pretty cool.
Eve. Mm-hmm. 10 letters. Starts with the letter E. So simple, even a school kid gets it.
Elementary.
Nice. Right.
Sarah D. Bunting. 6 letters. Starts with F. Big thing for some country western jackets.
Big thing for some country western jackets?
Yes.
I'm going to need a hint.
All right. This stars Stay Frosty, breakout hit actress Anna Torv. Anna Torv mystery box on Fox.
Oh, Fringe.
Fringe. Correct. Now, it is question 19. For Tara.
Yep.
6 letters, starts with E.
Yep.
Mongol or Ottoman?
Empire.
Eve. 7 mm-hmm. letters, starts with R. Idiomatically, it's best served cold.
Revenge.
Correct. 2 points. Sarah. 7 letters, starts with S. They pass for burgers at White Castle.
They pass for burgers at White Castle?
Correct.
Oh, fuck. I need a hint to buy myself some time. Thank you.
Sci-fi show that jumped dimensions and networks.
Dimensions and networks?
To recap, 7 letters, starts with S. First clue, they pass for burgers at White Castle. Second clue, sci-fi show that jumped both dimensions and networks.
Fuck, I can't pull it. I don't know. Tell me.
Anybody?
Sliders.
Sliders, yes.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Tara. Ugh.
Yes.
Everybody's last question of the second round coming at you. 8 letters, starts with the first letter of our alphabet, A.
Heard of it.
Celestial water bearer.
Aquarius.
Good for 2. E. Beatty, 9 letters, starts with N. N as in Mancy. Music City on the Cumberland.
It's actually N as in Norman. Don't confuse things.
Sorry.
Oh, shit, you guys. I was like counting the letters of Montreal just now.
N as in normal
Nashville.
Pronunciation of Mancy. With an N.
Nashville. My answer is Nashville. Nashville.
You dink.
Sarah D. Bunting. 9 letters. Starts with B. B as in Bunter. By definition, you can't see it.
9 letters?
Yeah, 9 letters. Starts with the letter B.
Oh, and I was the only one who actually watched it. Blind spot.
Tattoo-driven NBC actioner is a fantastic second clue for that. All right, that is 2/3 of the way through our game. So, Tara, scores, please.
It's still so close. Now, Eve and I are tied with 11 points each. Sarah barely trails us with 10.
All right, that means, Sarah, you're enjoying a solo trip, too.
Oh, all right.
This could change everything!
It won't!
Good luck!
All right, you know the drill, starting you off with classics. Who was Jonas Grumby's first mate?
Gilligan!
Correct. Sitcoms. What 50s high school student set a world's record by jumping 14 trash cans with his motorcycle in a 70s sitcom? what, 50s high school student set a world's record by jumping 14 trash cans with his motorcycle in a 70s sitcom.
I believe that is Arthur the Fonz Fonzarelli.
Not the first time you would jump over things, yes.
Oh, no. Well.
Drama. What PBS anthology series premiered on January 10th, 1971?
Masterpiece Theatre?
All right, you got your points, but now you have the opportunity to double them if you get the next three correct.
Oh, my God. It's too exciting.
Kids and Games. What country spawned the cartoon series Speed Racer, Gigantor, and Johnny Sacco and his flying robot?
Speed Racer is the first one?
Speed Racer, Gigantor, and Johnny Sacco and his flying robot.
Johnny Sacco and his flying robot.
That's S-O... Wait, hang on. S-O-K-K-O.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's some Scandinavian thing. The question is which one? Let us go, then. To Sweden.
No, it's that most elusive of Scandinavian countries. Japan. She didn't get the sweet, but she got... 2 points.
No. Nope.
4 points.
Yep.
So she's now leading by three.
Correct. All Sarah, right. Our scores are now even. I still tied with 11 points each. Sarah in the lead with 14.
I'm exhausted.
I said this could change everything, and I was right.
Let's get back to it. Our next batch is network comedies.
Okay.
Tutar.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 13 letters starts with B. Mm-hmm. B as in boy or bat.
Yep.
Physicist Edwin Hubble provided important evidence for it.
Big Bang Theory.
Bazinga Populizer.
He wrote that clue just to make you read it. Yeah.
Bazinga Popularizer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that might be my
drag name.
Yeah. Eve.
Yeah.
Four letters starts with J. Pooh's Roo, for one.
Pooh's Roo?
Pooh's, as in P-O-O-H, possessive. Roo, R-O-O, for one.
Show hint, please.
A friend by himself.
Joey.
Correct.
Sorry, just that the first time, I just couldn't compute those words. Thank you.
I was hearing R-O-U-X.
Yeah.
Couldn't figure it out, like the sauce.
Sarah D. Bunting. 16 letters starts with N. N as in Mancy.
N as in Norman. Don't be a dick.
If you have this, solar panels probably don't make financial sense.
If you have this. Hint, please.
It's all the way up in Alaska.
Oh, northern exposure.
You are correct. Good for one. Tara. 6 letters starts with S. Medical coverage often in blue or green.
Scrubs.
Eve. 5 letters starts with the letter W. Famous Buffalo Bar staple.
Show hint, please.
Airport-based 90s sitcom.
Wings.
Says the vegetarian. Sarah Bunter. 10 letters starts with U. Description of a freshman who's decided not to decide.
Undeclared.
Good for two. Tara.
Yes.
12 letters starts with H. Disney brought them to classic fairy tales.
Hint.
Alicia Cuthbert-based sitcom.
Happy Endings.
Oh. You are correct. Eve. 6 letters. Starts with C. Oh, God damn it. All right. Your clue. L'chaim. I hope I said that right.
6 letters starts with
C.
C.
As in cat.
C as in cat.
L'chaim.
I am.
Cheers. Cheers.
Correct.
Excellent.
Sarah D. Bunting. Nine letters. Starts with B. Before bothered and bewildered.
Bewitched.
Correct. She knows her songs. Everybody has one question left, so let's quickly get them current score, Star.
Well, I think she is too far ahead to be incontinent, but Eve has 15 points. I have 16 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 19 points.
All right, wow. Let's close it up with our Amazon streamers. Everybody has one of these. Tara.
Okay, yep.
Five letters starts with B.
Bosch.
Eve. 11 letters starts with T. T isn't Thomas. You can see right through it.
Transparent.
Correct. And for Sarah, closing out our game, 7 letters starts with F. Hotel with a lenient attitude towards cleanliness.
Fleabag.
Fleabag is correct. And that's end of regulation. And the final scores, please, Tara.
Well, everyone finished strong. Eve finished with 17. I had 18. Sarah is our winner in this game and this season with 21.
What an historic moment.
I retire. Goodbye.
I believe that is your first season victory, is it not, sir?
Yes, it is.
All right, before we get to the official congratulations, let's reuse our tiebreaker to get a steel meal for future use in our new season, which will start soon.
Yes.
This is all clues about one show. I'll keep on reading them until somebody guesses. Guess whenever you want.
Okay.
Here we go. 11 letters starts with the letter R. It keeps getting smaller. Birdless nesting objects. St. Petersburg souvenir.
Russian doll?
Russian doll.
Nice.
Gotta start off the new season in style with one delicious steel meal.
Gorgeous.
Mm.
Sarah D. Bunting, you've won the day. You've won the season. Congratulations on your first victory.
Thank you.
I am the warrior. Woo!
Well, I am the warrior. And hard to win if you survive.
Woo!
Well deserved, Sarah D. Bunter.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We'll get that plaque out to you this week. That is it, guys, for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We enjoyed free parking on our way to Pass and Go on the HBO documentary series McMillions before we ordered number 4 combo for Around the Dial, which included BoJack Horseman, The Outsider, The Good Place, and Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet. Everyone gave their opinion on the canon presentation for home movies. Everyone's entitled to my opinion. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time and the season. Remember...
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
ba-da-ba-ba-ba,
Sarah D. Bunting,
Intram,
and Eve Beatty,
I want a moving truck and a divorce.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grit.
The citizens of McDonaldland.
Yay!
Versus the Hamburglar. Order! Order in the court!
Your Honor, the accused Hamburglar was caught red-handed, sneaking off with a big bag full of McDonald's delicious cheeseburger.
That's serious.
My nephew was in that bag.
Order! Hamburglar, what do you have to say for yourself?
A likely story.
He's guilty!
Hamburglar, this court sentences you to 1 week without McDonald's cheeseburgers.
Isn't that rather severe?
Oh, well.
Wow.
Chicken McDonald's